Nemoto presents American Presidents. President Warren G. Harding. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 17 minutes. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project. A guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. On a humid July evening in 1921, the new President of the United States leaned back in the upholstered seat of a White House car rolling slowly up Pennsylvania Avenue. Warren Gamaliel Harding had just delivered a speech titled, Not Heroes, But Partners, praising the teamwork required to rebuild a nation emerging from war. Crowds lined the sidewalks, many of them smiling at the tall, handsome man with silver hair and movie star features. Veterans tipped their hats. Older women waved handkerchiefs. Reporters scribbled his every gesture. Harding acknowledged them with his characteristic easy warmth. He had a gift for it, an instinctive, almost unconscious ability to make people feel comfortable in his presence. More than any president since perhaps McKinley, he simply looked the part. Dignified, reassuring, polished in a way that restored confidence after years of turmoil. But inside the White House car, a different kind of unease traveled with him. Harding had been president only a few months, and already he sensed the undertow. He felt the shifting tensions within his cabinet, the quiet ambitions of certain old political allies, the complexities of large financial interests that trailed Republican administrations like a persistent scent. Later, long after his presidency had ended in tragedy and scandal, Harding's friends recalled that he sometimes confided a deep anxiety about the job. "I can deal with my enemies," he reportedly said, "but my friends, they're the ones who keep me awake." The nation saw something else entirely: stability, calm, a man who embodied a longing for normalcy after the upheavals of World War I. Harding had never been a deep thinker or a visionary. His strength lay in consensus and connection. Yet in the 3 short years he occupied the Oval Office, his administration would become one of the most paradoxical in American history. A mix of serious achievements, catastrophic betrayals, and a sudden death that left as many questions as answers. To understand the full story, you have to return to the beginning, to rural Ohio in the years after the Civil War, when a young boy named Warren grew up surrounded by fields, newspapers, and the quiet rhythms of Midwestern life. Warren G. Harding was born in 1865 near Blooming Grove, Ohio, just months after the Civil War ended. His father, George Tryon Harding, was a doctor and part-time farmer, known for his easy charm and country wisdom. His mother, Phoebe, deeply intelligent and politically engaged, had been a teacher before marrying and later trained as a midwife. The Harding household valued reading, debate, and community leadership. Politics, in particular, floated through the air like dust and sunlight, casual, omnipresent, part of the rhythms of daily conversation. As a young man, Warren excelled in school but not with brilliance. He was social, polite, popular, traits that would follow him through adulthood. At 14, he enrolled at Ohio Central College, a small Baptist-affiliated institution where he studied classics and editing, played in the band, and began to experiment with public speaking. He learned early how to project his voice and how to modulate his tone, acquiring the rich, warm baritone that later made him sound reassuring on the stump and resonant in the Senate. After graduation, Harding drifted briefly through local jobs before finding the work that would define his early career: newspapers. In 1884, at age 19, he and two partners purchased a struggling weekly called the Marion Star in Marion, Ohio. Over the next 10 years, Harding transformed the Star into a successful daily paper. Under his leadership, the Star grew profits, circulation, and local influence. Harding published editorials that were moderate, business-friendly, and always agreeable. Politics delivered not with fire but with a soft handshake. Running the newspaper also drew Harding into the social webs of Marion. He joined clubs, played poker, debated policy at the local opera house, and became something like the town's unofficial ambassador. His personality, the combination of good looks, approachable demeanor, and a talent for making people feel important, made him a natural politician. It was in the halls of the Star, too, that he met the woman who would change the arc of his life, Florence Kling DeWolf. Florence, known as Flossie, was confident, older than Harding, and fiercely intelligent. her managerial instincts far exceeded his. When they married in 1891, Florence soon took over many aspects of the newspaper's operation. People joked that she ran the business while Warren shook hands. But behind that humor sat truth. Harding's political rise was inseparable from Florence's discipline and ambition. She believed Warren was destined for greatness, and she pushed him to step from the newsroom into public office. Harding obliged. In 1899, he won election to the Ohio State Senate. In 1903, he became lieutenant governor. In 1914, he won a seat in the U.S. Senate, where he represented Ohio for 6 years. His Senate tenure was not especially distinguished in terms of legislative output, but he mastered the art of collegiality. He served on committees, cultivated friendships, maintained cordial relationships with Democrats and Republicans alike, and stayed away from fierce ideological fights. He opposed the League of Nations, reflecting the post-war skepticism of many Americans, but he did so without venom. Then came the presidential election of 1920. The nation felt exhausted, by war, by Woodrow Wilson's rigid idealism, by influenza, by social tensions, and by rapid industrial change. Americans wanted rest, predictability, and a return to familiar rhythms. Harding's genial face and calming voice seemed to promise exactly that. He was not the leading candidate at the Republican National Convention. In fact, he began the convention as a dark horse. The frontrunners were men like General Leonard Wood and Governor Frank Lowden. But the convention deadlocked, and powerful party bosses, men like Senator Henry Cabot Lodge and political fixer Harry Dougherty, began searching for a compromise candidate. Harding, who offended no one and pleased many, became the answer. On the 10th ballot, he secured the nomination. In the general election, Harding campaigned on a simple, powerful message: return to normalcy. It was, as slogans go, clunky and grammatically imperfect, but emotionally resonant. Harding spoke of calm after storm, of stability after sacrifice. He offered no sweeping program. What he offered was reassurance. Voters responded enthusiastically. Harding won one of the largest landslides in American history, carrying 37 of 48 states. When Harding took office in March 1921, the nation faced significant challenges. The economy had plunged into recession after the war. Prices were volatile. Farmers were suffering. Labor relations were tense. And Europe struggled to stabilize after the shattering costs of World War I. Harding's instinctive approach, delegation combined with moderation, led him to assemble a cabinet that was both one of the strongest and one of the weakest in American history. On the positive side, Harding appointed Herbert Hoover as Secretary of Commerce, Charles Evans Hughes as Secretary of State, and Andrew Mellon as Secretary of the Treasury. These men were intelligent, capable, and reform-minded in their respective spheres. Hughes guided foreign policy with professionalism. Hoover worked to standardize industry and improve labor relations. Mellon pushed for tax reductions and budgetary discipline, helping the economy transition from wartime to peacetime footing. But Harding also appointed political allies who proved disastrous. Chief among them were Attorney General Harry Dougherty and Secretary of the Interior Albert Fall. Both men were part of Harding's old political world, the world of backroom deals, patronage networks, and loose oversight. Harding valued friendship and loyalty almost excessively. He trusted these men even when evidence suggested he shouldn't. That trust would become the great moral fault line of his presidency. Yet in the first year of Harding's administration, the public saw promising signs. He called a special session of Congress to address tariffs, taxes, and farm relief. His leadership facilitated the passage of the Budget and Accounting Act of 1921, which created the Bureau of the Budget and the General Accounting Office, institutions that professionalized federal spending and added transparency to government finance. This act remains one of the most enduring accomplishments of his administration. Harding also supported the Washington Naval Conference of 1921 to 1922, an international gathering hosted by Secretary of State Hughes. Its aim was to limit naval armaments among the major powers at a time when a new arms race seemed possible. The conference produced agreements that curtailed battleship construction among the United States, Great Britain, Japan, France, and Italy. It was one of the first major examples of multilateral arms control and helped stabilize global relations in the decade following the war. On domestic policy, Harding sometimes surprised observers. He spoke publicly about the need for racial justice, advocating anti-lynching legislation, though he was unable to persuade Congress to pass it. On a tour of the South, he delivered a speech in Birmingham calling for equal political rights for Black Americans, a bold stance for a Republican president addressing an audience in the segregated Deep South. The reaction was mixed. Black leaders praised his courage. Southern whites denounced him. But the moment reflected a complexity often forgotten in portrayals of Harding as merely a weak or scandal-plagued leader. What Harding lacked was not heart, nor goodwill, nor even common sense. What he lacked was assertiveness, the willingness to discipline or remove those whose behavior threatened his administration. He was conflict-averse. He disliked confronting colleagues. He wanted harmony, sometimes to a fault. This weakness would prove fatal to his presidency's reputation. The so-called Ohio Gang, Harding's circle of political allies from his home state, began to abuse their positions. Some accepted bribes, others manipulated federal contracts, and still others used government office for personal gain. Harding may have suspected wrongdoing, but he hesitated to act. He hoped problems would resolve themselves or that friendly counsel would bring his associates in line. Instead, corruption metastasized. The most infamous scandal, which would break only after Harding's death, was the Teapot Dome affair. Secretary of the Interior Albert Fall secretly leased federal oil reserves at Teapot Dome, Wyoming, and Elk Hills, California, to private oil companies in exchange for bribes, cash, bonds, livestock, and more. Fall later became the first former cabinet official in American history to go to prison for crimes committed while in office. Harding did not orchestrate these schemes. He did not profit from them. But he appointed the men who carried them out and failed to stop them in time. The scandal would become synonymous with his administration, overshadowing his real accomplishments. By 1923, Harding was emotionally drained. He embarked on a cross-country journey he called the Voyage of Understanding, a tour meant to reconnect him with the American people and allow him to see the West. He traveled through the Pacific Northwest and north into Alaska, becoming the first sitting president to visit the territory. Crowds greeted him warmly, often ecstatically. Harding gave speeches, shook hands, posed for photographs. But inside, something was wrong. He appeared pale, tired, and increasingly frail. On the return trip, Harding fell seriously ill. He complained of indigestion, chest pain, and exhaustion. His doctors debated among themselves. They diagnosed everything except what was likely happening: heart failure. On August 2, 1923, while resting in a suite at San Francisco's Palace Hotel, Harding quietly died. He was 57 years old. His wife, Florence, was at his side reading to him. The nation was stunned. Harding had been enormously popular in life. Millions mourned him. His body was returned to Washington, where he lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. Tens of thousands filed past. Businesses closed. Flags flew at half-staff across the country. Newspapers described him as a healer, a peacemaker, a man who had restored calm after the storm of war. Only later, as investigations into the Ohio gang scandals unfolded, did Harding's reputation collapse. Teapot Dome dominated headlines. Congressional inquiries dragged Harding's name into a shadowy world of graft and abuse, even though he had not personally committed crimes. Rumors circulated about Harding's personal life, stories of extramarital affairs, secret payments, and even a daughter whispered to exist outside his marriage. Florence Harding, fiercely protective of her husband's legacy, burned many of his personal papers, making it difficult for historians to piece together the private dimensions of his life. Harding became, in the eyes of later generations, a symbol of presidential failure, a cautionary tale about the dangers of weak leadership, cronyism, and misplaced trust. But such a verdict, while partly deserved, obscures the fuller truth. Harding was not a villain. He was not a schemer. He lacked the ruthlessness required to cleanly excise corruption within his ranks, but he possessed genuine goodwill toward the American people. His economic policies helped the nation transition to stability. His international diplomacy reduced global tensions. His support for budget reform left an enduring institutional framework. His personal warmth gave millions a sense of comfort in uncertain times. The tragedy of Harding is not that he was corrupt. The tragedy is that he was too gentle for the world he entered, too trusting of men who were unworthy of that trust, and too eager to avoid conflict even when conflict was necessary. In that gap, between the pleasant surface and the turbulent depths, his presidency foundered. For a podcast listener absorbing Harding after the complex stories of Garfield and Arthur, the narrative takes a turn from assassination and reform to the temptations of prosperity and the hazards of political friendship. Harding's life underscores an important lesson. The character of the people around a president can shape a legacy as profoundly as the character of the president himself. Harding's greatest failures were not ideological, they were human. And his greatest strengths, kindness, affability, compassion, were not enough to compensate for the moral weaknesses of those he trusted. In the end, Harding remains one of the most misunderstood presidents. The caricature of the buffoonish, scandal-marred leader flattens the complexity of a man who rose from poverty to national office, who sought healing after war, who supported racial justice at moments when it was unpopular, who modernized parts of government in ways that still matter today, and who died unaware that history would treat him so harshly. His story invites reflection on leadership, morality, and vulnerability. It forces us to ask what makes a presidency succeed. Is it vision? Is it moral courage? Is it the ability to choose the right people? Harding's life suggests that all three matter, and that lacking even one can leave an administration dangerously exposed. He was a man who craved harmony in a world that required vigilance, who loved people too much to suspect the worst, who believed that decency could guide government the way it guided small-town friendships. In the vast machinery of federal power, that belief, so sincere and so human, was not enough. And yet the memory of Harding the man, not Harding the scandal, still carries something warm. A reminder that sometimes American presidents, for all their flaws, are simply trying to give their country a moment to breathe.